You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If Mark Antony wanted Romans to lend him their ears, nowadays he'd probably tweet, although he'd need a catchy meme. Google would sell data analysis of his tweets to the NSA and Amazon could place ads to nudge more followers. Attention is big business. Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia and author of The Master Switch, discusses the market for our attention for us in his latest book, The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Tim Wu back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be here again.
Now, who are the attention merchants?
So, you know, they used to be a pretty confined group of businesses. Originally, just the old line media, newspapers, or television stations. But over the last years, the business model has expanded nearly everywhere, so that the companies interested in gathering up your attention and reselling it cover a whole range of activities. Most of the internet companies, you know, it's almost everywhere. And the basic thing they have in common is they want you as a consumer really to be their product so they can resell you to someone else. And that's the model.
Are there non-commercial attention merchants?
You know, not really the way I see it. I mean, you might think of politicians that way. They mm-hmm. gather up huge crowds to have power. Actually, in the history of the 20th century, you can think of propaganda states as attention mm-hmm. merchants in a way. But they're not commercial. Their interest was, for example, gathering up a huge army to go march on another country. British and American propaganda, World War One being the pioneer. So if they're non-commercial, it's for political power.
Hasn't this election ended up being about attention? One of the complaints from Sanders supporters was that the media ignored him.
I mean, absolutely. I think that this election was the final merger of entertainment and politics. You know, people have been talking about it for a long time, but you know, the prospect of someone with no experience at all using incredible powers of attention harvesting, like a master of creating a plot that every week there's a new scandal or something else happens, you know, has amounted to billions of dollars of free coverage for Donald Trump's presidency. And presidential campaign. And so elections have long been attentional contests, but what has happened is the techniques of entertainment and the entertainment industry have certainly moved fully into the political realm, and that's what we're seeing.
Has human attention been turned into a commodity, something that can be bought or sold?
I mean, I'd say absolutely. You know, the industries have become so much more sophisticated in targeting your attention at the exact right moment. So one of the reasons that Google has been so successful is that they offer you not just, you know, like a radio listener, well, that's an attractive audience as well, but they offer you right at the moment you're making a decision. You're looking for something. So I want to buy, let's say, a new seat for my nursery or something. And they know that. And so it's not only just your attention that's being resold, but it is your mind at a specific decisional state. And so I think it's become much more specific.
How related are trade in attention and control of attention? If you can control attention, can you set the agenda?
Well, that's the first step. So in our times, the prerequisite to anything, getting started, political campaign, a new product, you know, a new movement, you were talking about Bernie Sanders, is you have to somehow get attention or nothing happens at all. I mean, Bernie Sanders' campaign is a great example. He just was running hard. He had a lot of ideas that people were interested in, could not get attention for the first several months. And so it was as if he lost the battle before the battle. So before you have any control over attention, you can't start trading your product. No one buys something they've never heard of, you know. Even if you lower your price, let's say you have the latest and greatest new sunglasses and they're half the price. Well, if no one knows they exist, the market can't function. So that's how they're related.
Haven't producers of one kind or another been competing for attention or marketplaces for thousands of years? Is the difference that the mediums or the media, as we should say, have changed?
So here's what I think has changed. So obviously there's have been people selling things and wanting you to buy their products for thousands of years, you know, since the invention of currency or something.
Or humans have been presenting themselves
right,
as something right, to be right. selected.
Yeah, but what's new, in fact, what was founded in this city in the New York Penny Press, 1830s, I'm going to point to the New York Sun as a starting point of this, was the idea that you sell something very cheap, like a newspaper, and you gather up a big crowd, and then that audience is then your product. You see, it's a very different, it's an unusual business model. And that's different than the usual business model of just selling something. So a book publisher, you know, you pay $10 or $20, $30, and you buy a book, and that's the end of the transaction. A different model where you would give the book away for free, everyone reads it, and then you resell the people reading it to another person. So it's a much different business model. And what's strange is just how many parts of our life it's taken over. You know, all of the web, you know, mobile phones, anywhere you get something for free and you wonder, why is this free? It's probably because you are being resold. So I think that's important for listeners to understand.
But we're getting out of this trade, we're getting the free part?
We get, the consumers get the free part.
Because there's right. a popular line, if you're not paying, you are the product.
Right, and I think that is exactly right. When you are not paying, when you're getting a free newspaper or free internet services, so if you're not paying in some way or another, yet exactly, you are being resold. Access to your mind is the commodity, yeah.
That's the hidden price we're paying.
Yeah, that is the hidden price. And I think it has its cost when you really look carefully at it. What happens is the media that are completely advertising dependent need to have you in a receptive mood and constantly ready for advertising. And that constrains what kind of messages work well. On the internet, for example, you know, the internet 15 years ago was a lot of blogs and sort of maybe more thoughtful if amateur writing. These days, it is all about clickbait. You know, it's all about what can I get someone to click, 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 click on. And so the whole medium has warped itself, transformed itself, become a low attention, click forever, casino effect kind of medium because it is driven by ad revenue.
I'm speaking with Tim Wu, whose latest book is The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. Are the issues you discuss arising around the world, even in different kinds of economies like China's?
You know, I think we lead the world in this business model. And
should we be proud of that?
it's a good question. I mean, this is a particularly American phenomenon and one in which we invented it. And with the success of our most powerful internet companies overseas, we are exporting it, you know, to support a global audience and global reselling of audience. So I think to the extent it's appearing overseas, it's pioneered by Americans.
Are media companies and advertisers nudging us in the sense that's been described by Cass Sunstein, Daniel Kahneman, and others?
One of the things that I think is going to happen over the next decade is that because many people have become much more resistant to advertising. They try to skip it or avoid it or block it. There is a move towards what Professor Mayer Einstein calls black ops advertising, or there's this move towards making the manipulation much more subtle. So if you might imagine, you know, let's say you have a self-driving car in the future. Well, how does it decide which route to take? You know, how does it decide which gas stations to go to? There's a big market because we have become, as I said, resistant to advertising. There is a strong market for nudging us subtly, almost surreptitiously steering our preferences. I'm concerned, for example, about the rise of, the Internet of Things, which could be great, but could also end up where we have a refrigerator or a washing machine, which is trying to sell us, you know, this kind of detergent or, you know, says, well, I really want Tide. I don't want that cheaper brand or something like that. And these are trends that concern me.
Well, we tend to think that we can just get rid of the advertising on the Internet. In fact, the Internet advertising was considered less effective initially because
right.
you just zip right past it, whereas mm-hmm. in a newspaper, you're confronted with that right-hand page.
I think that has changed. I mean, if you've use the internet lately, it's really tough to get around it. You know, think about YouTube, for example. It's come to the point where you almost have to watch as much advertising as video to watch it. It's got, you know, that was 15 years or 10 years ago. It's become so hard to avoid. On the other hand, there are technologies for avoiding it, which are being employed in something of a revolt. But I think the ad load, as the jargon is, the amount of advertising on the internet has become close to unbearable for many people.
And then the New York Times and others now offer what are called native ads, ads that blend in with content looking like news. This is the opposite of the old idea that you called attention to yourself through a special typeface, to distinguishing yourself from what the rest of the print looked like. Now you want it to look like a news story?
It is part of the trend of trying to make advertising more surreptitious, more subtle. It's not a trend I'm fond of. If you look at the long history of advertising and advertising-supported media, it has always posed ethical questions. You know, from the early days of the penny press in this city, where they, to attract larger audiences, would run, and this is something you can learn more about, they would run stories that were false but exciting, like the discovery of life on the moon, just to gather a large audience. My point is that there's always a temptation when you have advertisers to run at the ethical limits. And one of those limits is running articles that look like real articles but are advertising. Actually, you know, you say people wanted to mark themselves off. 100 years ago, there was more interest in just running advertisements, what were really advertisements but look completely like news stories. So, for example, Discovered. I read this when I was researching the book. An 1880 story, Discovered the Cure for Death. You know, the elixir of immortality has been discovered, Dr. So-and-so. It looked completely like a normal news article. And then at the end of it, for details on how you can get the elixir of immortality, please write this address. So it's an advertisement, but it looks like a news story. So people read it and they say, well, they've discovered the cure for death. I think I better buy that. So
I wonder how many suckers bought that.
A lot. That patent medicine, one of the great inventors of advertising, forces behind it, was a multi-billion dollar, one of the biggest industries late 19th century, and it was mainly because of their advertising, because people thought that was the real deal.
Shouldn't economists for ad agencies and companies buying ads take note that there's demand for ad blockers and other tools to get around advertising?
Well, I think they are taking account of that fact. And what I hope, here's my optimistic take, is, you know, having looked at the long history of this in my writing, there are periodic revolts by consumers against advertising. And one of the situations we have, particularly on the web, is we have a very unstable situation where the ads are so so intrusive and so privacy-defeating that people are starting to revolt. And I think that revolt will push things back to a more sustainable level. But I do think we need, I do think they need to take into account, and that's partially why they're moving to these more surreptitious advertising.
But they still have to use advertising. For example, big tobacco fought regulation, mm-hmm. and also the science of smoking's risks, as was, that story was told in by Eric Conway and Naomi Oreskes in Merchants of Doubt. More recently, we've seen similar things in ads about the fact that global warming does not exist. Have merchants of attention been trying to influence regulation or science all along?
I mean, the history, I don't know where you start since the very, very beginning. I'll mention also a related phenomenon is that there was a period where, you know, attention merchants, I'm talking about CBS and NBC in the 1950s, allowed their news, you'll be maybe interested in this, allowed their news to be sponsored by tobacco labels. And so, for example, the news show, the main news show on NBC in the 50s was the Camel News Caravan, Camel Cigarettes. And somehow, mysteriously, in their news show never reported on the links between cancer and tobacco. Somehow that missed them. They had other rules, too. They weren't allowed to show pipes or cigars on the show. So there was a long history of attention merchants having an interest in using whatever power they can muster to influence public policy.
I'm speaking with Tim Wu, who is a law professor at Columbia University. His previous book was the bestseller, The Master Switch, and now we are discussing The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopp. We will continue our conversation after a brief break. We'll be right back. We're back with Tim Wu, who is a law professor at Columbia University. Also, he is the author of a number of books. The one we're discussing is The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It is published by Knopf. You begin your book with a description of advertising making its way into public schools. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, this is really kind of a unfortunate story to my mind. There's been a huge problem with funding for a lot of public schools in poorer parts of the country. And one of the things they've turned to is advertising. And the idea is, of course, that you have young audiences who are captive. And
aren't children particularly susceptible to advertising?
And very, very impressionable. So, you know, the image of Ronald McDonald or Coca-Cola or whatever it is can stay in people's minds for a very long time. And that's the reason, by the way, advertisers usually like younger audiences, because you could build a lifetime of brand association. And so, whether it's the lockers being completely covered with banner ads, whether it's sponsored stadiums, sometimes they have teaching modules that have ideas. Advertising has come to a lot of public schools, and I think it's an unfortunate thing.
And kids nowadays have smartphones. They may use several devices at once. For example, they can watch television while they're networking on their phones. Are attention merchants encouraging that or trying to capitalize on it?
You know, I think the same logic of trying to reach younger audiences is everywhere, and I think it's not restricted to any particular medium of advertising. And smartphones are just a very good platform. I mean, it's obviously not children having platforms, but teenagers, a very helpful platform for getting at those audiences.
Content is often very brief. Snapchat videos can be no longer than 10 seconds. Tweets are limited to 140 characters, although pictures and videos now can be added to them. Is new technology whittling away at our attention spans?
I think one of the consequences of an advertising model that backs so many things is you need people constantly being distracted, looking at new things, homo distractus, who's ready for something else. The businesses rely on advertising don't want you sitting down and reading a book for 3 hours. That's like stealing from them, or you know what I mean? In the sense, there's no ad exposure. So if you look at content, I mean, television was already kind of like that with sitcoms, and you every 10 minutes or something, there's an ad. But now we've gotten to the points where every 5 seconds or so, there's a new click, a new ad, a new payload. And so I think that the structure of economy is creating this kind of sensation people have, where they have short attention spans, feel very distracted. You know, it's not us. I mean, it is us, but it's not in the sense it's our faults. It's this kind of crazy environment we live in, which it's almost like a casino. I don't know if you've had this experience where you sit down to the internet. Maybe you're going to write an email, and then suddenly you notice 4 hours have gone by. You've clicked on 50 different things. You've been exposed to who knows how many different ads or subtle messages or tracking technologies. And that's kind of what's driving us crazy. And so I'm saying it's not just us and the way we use our technologies. It's that the technologies are programmed to make us receptive to advertising content.
It seems almost addictive. It's rare when I get into an elevator and all the other people in the elevator aren't looking at their smartphones. Many thought that the internet would have a democratizing influence, giving more control to people. How are things turning out?
Well, that's a complicated question. I don't think you can answer it up or down, democracy or not. On the one hand, there's been a huge proliferation number of voices that are heard. And, there are bloggers who've been able to compete with major news outlets, and I think that's worth crediting. On the other hand, I think we've seen over the last 10 years a consolidation into a few really big platforms that was not predicted, who have much more control over your time and attention than anyone else. The attention economy has had a few big winners. And I think that is, I don't think it's like quite a threat to democracy at this point, but it is certainly different than people thought at the beginning of the internet.
Who are the current leaders among the attention merchants?
I mean, in the world, if you talk about the internet, it's very clearly the big attentional platforms: Google, Facebook, the most obvious among them, Twitter, sort of, and others behind them. And they have,
not if Donald Trump has his say.
Yeah, that's true. He's going to He's someone who has been very successful in using these platforms to their fullest extent. I'll say that much.
The big three television networks are trying to catch up with HBO, Netflix, and Amazon. So that's changing as well.
No, I agree. It's from a business perspective, it is a very interesting time where they're all competing. They don't know what the rules are. And it is, as we said, very much competition for attention and competition for eyeballs. It's just unclear that what we're going to be left with at the end is something that we find attractive. And I'm particularly concerned, I mean, business is business, the media is usually a business, but I'm particularly concerned that everything being ad-driven models, that it'll all lead to the sort of the bottom, which is something that's happened to television before and something that's happened on the internet and web with clickbait. And obviously, I think that's a bad development.
In your previous book, The Master Switch, and now in The Attention Merchants, you wrote about Theodore Newton Vail and the new technology company he led, AT&T. How were they... How did they influence the market for our attention?
Well, AT&T plays a much lesser role in this book, but they must be they must get their credit for starting the first radio network. This is not really well known, but the first radio station that was connected to all the other radio stations and therefore would gather up huge, you know, millions of people at once and send them a single message.
That was WEAF.
My memory slightly fails me, but WEAF. That's exactly right.
And they supposedly ran the very first on-air ad.
That's true, which I believe was for a housing complex in Queens, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, why would AT&T want a radio station?
Well,
it's a telephone company. And telegraph.
For one thing, it's all communications. For another, they connected the radio station. So that the reason they were a network is they own the long lines, the wires that connected all the radio stations together. And they, I think, saw it as just part of their ever-increasing empire. I mean, at that point, they had already monopolized the telephone, so where was there to go next? And that was the radio. Their network eventually became NBC, so people don't always know this. But
RCA, which was owned by General Electric, acquired it. That became NBC in 1926.
That's right.
And did they have any competition at the beginning?
At the beginning, very little. I mean, there was still local radio. In fact, there still is local radio. eventually, though, CBS grew to be a competitor.
Well, you say we're local. It's interesting. WMYC is local. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have listeners all over the world because of the internet.
Right. Well, that's one of the many ways in which the world has changed. We're in this strange point of history where things can be intensely local, as you just pointed out, but then also intensely international or national at the same time. And I actually think things are going back towards that. There's not much room left in the middle, you know, either intensely local or completely international and national.
David Sarnoff was the guiding force behind NBC, and then William Paley led CBS. What strategies did they adopt for their companies?
You know, William Paley of CBS is one of the most fascinating figures in media history, kind of a type lost to our times. And he's a very interesting story because he understood better than anyone something that we all take for granted, which is that programming, the mixture of content would be for the key for accumulating these massive audiences and reselling them to advertisers. NBC was weirdly, I won't say completely indifferent to content, but sort of careless in how they chose it. But CBS was the master in the early radio and then the early television of putting together prime time in just a certain way that would, and choosing the right people. You know, he understood Lucille Ball, who was a sort of B-rated actress, would be a hit with audiences. He put together the first game shows. They had the $64,000 question. You know, he understood the innate appeal of these things and how they could get millions of people. I mean, it's really extraordinary what CBS did and NBC. And if I can just finish on this, they managed to get, you know, 50 or 70 million people every night watching the same thing. It's almost never happens now other than presidential debates and Super Bowls.
But even the presidential debates, it gets spread out over a number of different stations. Then right. you had pretty much two, and then later with ABC, three networks that dominated most of the viewership.
Right.
Cable came in, and then other stations, other networks were formed, and now it's really spread out.
It is spread out. I mean, it's amazing. If you get an audience of a million people, that's a pretty great accomplishment. So that era, the 50s, I think it's remarkable. The only entities that had succeeded in gaining those kind of audience previously were totalitarian regimes like the Nazi radio, which managed to had the whole population listening. One reason why, if you didn't, you were punished. They had the Third Reich is also a fascinating actor in this because they had prime time. The only difference is you were listening to Hitler, and you were forced to listen. But they did also have this, you know, 70, whatever, millions of people listening.
We still have that in North Korea.
Oh, yeah, they do.
There's one radio station, and you have to keep it on.
Right.
Weren't the early ads on radio pretty dry, almost infomercials? When did they start becoming entertainment in their own right?
Well, that's an interesting story. The reason that they were dry, as you say, was because the idea of advertising on radio was thought of as completely outrageous in the early 1920s.
And people objected at the beginning?
People objected. Not only the people who ran radio objected. There was this scientific miracle, and we're going to pollute it with advertisements for diapers and shoes. I mean, you must be kidding. You know, Hoover, when I gave a big speech, he said, we cannot allow this miracle of radio to be corrupted by advertising. And so the beginnings of radio advertising were sponsored programs. So Gillette, for example, sponsored a program on the history of the beard and said, you know, sponsored by Gillette. And so sponsorship was the first way. And then the sponsorship got more elaborate. Pepsodent sponsored this show, Amos and Andy, which Amos and Andy was the first big primetime hit. And they, at the end of every show, they'd say, you know, sponsored by Pepsodent toothpaste, go to your dentist and brush twice a day.
But that was it.
That was it. But then it got longer. So then they would say, sponsored by Pepsodent, did you know that Pepsodent uses an unbelievable whitening agent, which we have invented, which keeps your breath clean and also whitens your teeth and blah, blah. So they became longer and longer and longer. So it's more like a commercial. Most things in advertising happen that way. They start with this tiny kind of subtle thing that doesn't seem like much, and then it gets longer and longer and longer.
Although we had a very different model for broadcasting than other countries. In Europe, most of the countries had created national government-run broadcasters. We didn't actually wind up with public broadcasting until fairly late.
No, that's exactly right. Public broadcasting is here we are at a public radio station. Did not begin until the late 1960s. Well, there was earlier stations, but NPR, the invention of this, is in the late 60s.
There were college stations and others.
College stations, early 60s. And, you know, I think, just to say this, there is a difference, and this is kind of the main message of my book, is the economic model of the media changes the message. It seems obvious, but public radio, I mean, here you are listening to it, it is a lot different than commercial ad-supported radio, and, you know, Wikipedia is a lot different than clickbait, and I think we really need to start thinking about what kind of media we want. That's part of why, during the break, I gave a donation, I'll have to admit. I've come to believe that we really need to support the media that we want to see, that what you pay for, you will end up seeing. Sorry, I'm going on a little bit here, but I've come to think that's very important.
But aren't we attention merchants as well in public broadcasting?
I think you are in a different model. I mean, you gather a large audience, but last time I've checked,
we definitely want attention.
Yeah, sure, but that's different. There's a difference between being an attention merchant and being merely attention seeking. And so I think there's a role for, you know, public for broadcasting. I'm not saying that no one can speak to audiences. You just have to talk to your friends. But what you don't do, at least I don't think you do, is say, okay, look, I've got this many listeners, and you know, I'm going to subtly put in a pitch for Ray-Ban sunglasses into this interview. I guess I just did that, but you know what I mean. Like, there's not another set of transactions. You and I.
I think my boss has heard me slipping in secret little plugs for different commercial enterprises. I'd get in a lot of trouble.
No, and this is really right. This is a serious issue. Is you and I think, at least I'm trying to just speak to our you know, audiences, and we're not trying at some subtle way to try to present selling opportunities for another set of corporate institutions who want us to somehow make them buy something. So that's a very different set of motives. And I think those motives can be quite corrupting over the long term, as my history suggests.
There are a host of fairly new areas of study: data analytics, big data, neuroscience, behavioral economics. How are they being used by the attention merchants?
So this is all within the last 10 years. The idea in advertising has been, you know, the rise of ad tech and other technologies is to try to get, you know, basically much more scientific and isolate people much more carefully as to who exactly they are, when they're interested in buying, what kind of life events are going on. You know, a company like Facebook is very sophisticated in this respect. They can tell by watching very carefully that either, you know, that someone's pregnant or expect, sometimes before the people themselves are pregnant or expecting it or moving or something. And knowing that people buy things around major life events has motivated an effort to try and target just the right message at just the right time.
Well, didn't Mark Zuckerman do a dual concentration in psychology and computer science before he dropped out of college and created Facebook?
He did, and I thought it was interesting. People would say, why are you wasting your time with psychology? And, you know, he's a geek. Other geeks would be, isn't that stuff a waste of time? And he said, it's not a waste of time.
With social networking and media, aren't we ourselves creating the stuff that's competing for our attention?
One of the kind of, you know, sometimes you look at stuff where people a generation ago would say, how did they let that happen? Somehow we've allowed our own content, you know, the stuff we create, is pictures of toddlers, you know, news about family, to become hooks for advertising. And actually, the weird part is we don't get paid. I mean, I have a daughter, I have two daughters, but a daughter whose pictures are, you know, very cute and people like, obviously, all my friends like to see it. But for, putting those pictures on Facebook, I'm also providing content for advertisers to piggyback on. And sometimes I think, like, this is crazy. When did I agree to do this? And I guess it was the day I signed up for Facebook.
But meanwhile, you've written a book that you hope will get some attention here.
Well, that's the name of the game. I mean, you know, it's a very competitive market, and you have to accept it. You can either rail against it or say that to get things started in this day and age, it begins with attention.
Just one more thing before you leave. We associate you with the development of net neutrality theory. Mm-hmm. How's net neutrality doing these days?
Not bad. I think the administration's done a terrific job in passing a new net neutrality rule, and it survived attack in the courts. So, you know, at least for now, that danger, which is the danger of the big telecom companies taking over free expression, is at least temporarily in abeyance.
Tim Wu is a policy advocate and professor at Columbia Law School. His latest book is called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopf. Thank you for being on our show again.
Oh, it's great. I've loved it.